At this time, I'd like to call upon Dr. Carl Olson, whom many of us know as Mr. United Presbyterian Men in this Synod. Carl has done perhaps more than any other clergyman to help this work and to support it through the years. And it was through Carl's friendship, close friendship with Dr. Judd, that we were able to obtain his services 2 years ago this time and again this year. We're very much indebted to Dr. Carl Olson, and I would like to call upon him to introduce our speaker this afternoon. Carl.
You have heard, as I have many times, someone who is introducing a speaker says this man needs no introduction. And if that has ever been true, it is this afternoon. But I'm going to say a few things, not because he needs to be introduced, because I first came to know him 50 years ago this September. And during these years, I have followed him with intense interest. And I have found that he has not deviated any way, as far as I can discern, from the original goal and purpose of his life when I first came to know him. He was born on a farm near Racing City, Nebraska. He had a very vital experience in a YMCA meeting where he decided that he was not going to turn his back on the great issues of today, but he was going to commit himself to the cause of trying to change some of these problems that are facing us. He worked his way through university, same as I did. Consequently, I can relate to him in that respect. He was a brilliant student at the University of Nebraska Medical School. And when he concluded there, many opportunities came to him to go to various hospitals to serve as a surgeon. But I heard him say then that many are willing to accept these offers, but no one that I know of is willing to do what I'm going to do. I'm going to China, and I'm going to live with the people there. And he did just that. He did not get married. He went as a single man. He slept in their homes and slept in their beds and ate their food. I remember when he returned, when he said one time, that I'm surprised oftentimes when I look in the mirror and I see that my face is not yellow. He had so completely identified himself with the Chinese people. He contracted malaria many times, I think over 40 times. And because of his health, he had to return to the United States, and medical experts said that he could never go back to China. Practicing here a while, he recovered his health. Married, perhaps that had something to do with his recovery of his health. And he went back to northern China, where the malaria was not as prevalent, to be in charge of a hospital. And while he was there, he did a tremendous work. A year before he was left, or before even 5 or 7 months before he was taken captive, he had his wife to return to the States because he knew what was ahead of him. He was taken captive by the Chinese communist and sentenced to die several times. One time he got his reprieve from someone whom he had helped, ministered to as a physician. And yet he stayed steadfast to his convictions. He came back knowing the impending danger that the United States was facing with reference to World War II. And our supplying of Japan with strategic weapons, metals. He took the few dollars, and I think it's something over $1,000, his wife and himself, and spent every bit of it traveling all over the United States speaking to warn the United States. However, they were not ready to listen and would not heed his warning. And he was speaking in a Minneapolis church when the bombs were dropped over Hawaii. This man has been true to his convictions. I remember him as a student volunteer. I became a member of it myself. I received a tremendous inspiration from this man. And anything that I've been able to accomplish, I owe to him in a very large ministry, large way, the thrust of my ministry. And when after he had spoken many times in this country, a few friends of his and mine, Harlan Nygaard in particular, who is a very close friend, a brother of my best friend, Dr. Norman Nygaard, went to Dr. Judd and told him that he'd better put up or shut up, that he'd been speaking all over the country. It was time now to go to Washington. Finally, submitting to a draft, he was not even able to vote for himself because he hadn't lived in the district from which he had been elected. He was not a politician. Doctors and ministers and church people and lay people generally went out and accomplished a tremendous upset, and he was elected to Congress. He served there for 20 years, during which time he was elected by his own colleagues as one of the five most outstanding men in Congress. Whenever he spoke, there were always plenty of people to listen to him. This man twice spoke over the national network, maybe more, at the Republican National Convention, once to be the keynote speaker, another time to introduce a nominee for the Republican nomination for president. Perhaps Walter could have been the president of the United States if he had chosen to have been that. In fact, I was one who plugged for him in that area. Dr. Judd, however, went there because he believed that here was a mission for him to accomplish. I remember, too, that this man has always stayed by the convictions of the beginning, as I said it, of his life, as I said it some time ago. When he was in Washington, he had a profound influence upon the Congress and upon the United States. After he left Congress, showing the respect that he has among his medical colleagues, he had been elected for some time, I don't know how long, as chairman of the Judicial Commission of the American Medical Association, which decides cases of ethics among the medical profession. A man who is recognized by the Bar Association speaking nationally, the National Educational Association, church groups everywhere, who perhaps has received more honorary degrees from universities than any man living today. It's not necessary for me to introduce him except to say that here's a man who comes with a conviction, who has been true to that conviction, and he does not come as a physician, not as a former congressman or legislator. He comes as a man dedicated to the cause and purpose of Jesus Christ, his Savior and Lord, Walter.
Well, you sort of get put behind the eight ball when somebody introduces you as more than generously as Carl has. And so you've known him a long time, as you said, Dr. Carr, so you won't take it too seriously, all of he said. Chinese have a saying, yi shang xin de hao, ren shu de hao, with clothes, the new are best, but with friends, the old are best. And so I appreciate it. Even though you spread it on too thick, I appreciate it just the same. Now, when he asked me to come, I hesitated because my wife says, whenever I get up, wherever I start, I always wind up the same place. And I've been here before, and I didn't like to be inflicted on you again. But when Carl asked me, I wasn't anything else I could do. I was like Adam when Eve said to him, Adam, dear, do you really love me? And he said, who else? So I had no choice except to come. But you'll forgive if we have to discuss some of the same problems as last time, because they're still here. And if the patient's got the same problems he had when you first saw him, and this may be the 10th time, you still have to deal sometimes with the problems, trying to find the right answer or how to get the answer applied. I remember starting, I always keep notes on what I've said last time, that never had there been a time in our country's history, I thought, characterized by so great a mixture of emotions as is the case today. Because never did any people have so much to be grateful for as we do in this beautiful, blessed land. We're free. You didn't have to come to this meeting. Nobody lined you up and marched you down here. But nobody could stand out there and forbid your coming. What wouldn't one-third of all God's men and women on this planet give today for the chance to make that kind of simple, taken for granted, everyday choice? What they're going to do with their time, where, what they're going to do with their lives, and so on. You could go down through the whole list. More things to be grateful for, and yet I dare say there's never been a time in America's history characterized by greater uneasiness, uncertainty, perplexity, dismay, anxiety. Half the doctor's patients today are filled with some sort of anxiety of one kind or another. Here we are 28 years after we won a war. Japan surrendered 28 years ago last Sunday. We had superiority in every field, economic, military, and I think commanding greater confidence and even affection than any country in history ever commanded on a worldwide scale. And now, after 28 years, we're talking about survival. How could so much be lost in so short a time? What went wrong with our thinking that we'd come from our all-time high to our all-time low, where there's less confidence in us around the world and less confidence in ourselves right here at home than at any time, at least in my lifetime, and probably yours? Well, a lot of things have happened in these years, 28 years. For one thing, a third of the people of the world gained their independence in these 27 years, really. This process began 27 years ago in Manila, July 4th, 1946. And we pulled down the American flag and ran up the Filipino flag. No riots, no bloodshed, no pressures, no demonstration. This is what we wanted to do. This is what we told them we'd do. It was in accordance with our own history, our own character, I think, at our best, and we did it. This started a process which, of course, was irreversible and irresistible. And in these 27 years, a billion people have gotten their independence out of the disintegration of the old colonial system, mostly run from Western Europe. 70-some newly independent countries. And most of them without any previous experience in self-government, in larger units than the family or the tribe. Well, of course, there are things go wrong. One country in Africa, when it got its independence, had a total of 6 college graduates. Now, we get upset about our bureaucrats, but you can't run a government without some bureaucrats. You got to have somebody that can add and subtract and knows how to keep books and run the police and the schools and keep order on the highways and so on. Strange things, not that there have been troubles, the strange thing is how well they've done, considering the lack of preparation, which was not their fault. They didn't have a chance to develop these skills. The colonial power made all the major decisions. But in these same 27 years, another billion people lost their independence. And these weren't people without previous experience in managing their affairs. Some of the oldest and most sophisticated peoples of history, Latvians, Lithuanians, Poles, Czechs, Hungarians, Romanians, Bulgarians, Chinese, Koreans, Vietnamese, and so on. People with longer histories of competent management of their affairs than we have had. No two such convulsions in all human history have occurred as have occurred in these last 27 or 8 years. It's not surprising that there's uncertainty, uneasiness, dislocation, this period of transition. Is it to be better or worse? Is it to be violent or is it to be peaceful, constructive or destructive? uneasiness. I said last time that if I had two words to pick out of the English language to describe our time, the two I would pick out are conflicts and confusion. There have always been conflicts, and I'm sure there always will be, but I think it's correct to say this is the first time when all continents and all cultures and all countries have been in turmoil, unrest, even disruption or violence at the same time. And not only is this true around the world, of course it's true here at home in a greater sense than has been the case in the least, except for the one, in our whole history, except for the one great conflict of 100 years ago. But that was on one issue only, slavery. How to end the institution of slavery without destroying the Union. But now our conflicts are on a dozen fronts. There are five basic institutions in every society. The first is the home, the social institution. This is the fundamental, and ours is in dislocation. Who is to have the say in the home, the parents or the children? Or perhaps some different new pattern. And the second, I think you'd say, was the school, the educational unit. Well, surely there's dislocation now. The things that you and I were brought up to believe, they're passé, they're old-fashioned. They belong to the puritanical restrictions that damaged people's personalities. Let them loose without any restraint, and so on. Who is to have the say in the school? The scholars or the students? Or maybe some different pattern. And the third institution is the economic, where people work, farm and factory and marketplace, where they produce or manufacture, process and distribute products that people need. It's often said by the some people, oh, everything's profits, profits, profits. But you can't make any profit if you don't sell your product or your service, and you can't sell your product or your service unless it meets some human need. If it doesn't help satisfy something that people want, they won't buy it. You got to serve before you can profit. Well, we forget it. We just talk about the profits. And if you only did it for profits, yes. But if you're intelligent profits, you got to help people. Help meet some need that they have. And yet, look at our economic system dislocated. We know other people couldn't balance their budget, but we can't balance ours. We've seen other people's currency deteriorate, but ours goes down. We've seen all kinds of things happen. We kind of felt sorry for those unfortunate people around the world. And yet we don't quite know how to manage our own, do we? And then there's the fourth, the political unit, the state, government. You got to have government. Our forefathers fought for 700 years from Magna Carta on down to reduce the powers of government so people could have these powers. To give people rights. And now the solution for almost every problem is to turn some more of them back. Isn't it a strange irony? Every poll I've seen, Gallup and Lou Harris and the rest of them on this, where they've checked through some 20 professions as to their influence and credibility with the American public. And down at the bottom are the news media and the advertising people. And third from the bottom is politicians and government. And everybody else care up at the top. I've always plowed that my profession still is, with all the difficulties individually, the doctor is more respected than anybody else, according to all these polls. The irony is that whenever there's a problem, we turn it over to the politicians in whom we have least confidence. And out of the hands of the people in whom we have greater confidence. Groping, you see, uncertain. And then, of course, there's the fifth basic human institution, the religious, the temple. And it's in confusion and conflict, where it deals with the relation of man to man and the relation of man to God. Are the Judeo-Christian ethics on which our society was founded and grown great, are they relevant for our time? Yes, for those ancient times, but do those principles apply to us today? Or is God dead or never was? Well, these are some of the just a sketch of the problems we face as you meet at the beginning of this conference. There's always been the criticism that Christians don't live up to their professions, and we don't. This is a legitimate criticism. And it's our own youth are calling us on the carpet for it. Good. But there's another one that disturbs me even more, and that is the criticism that the principles don't apply today. They aren't essential for our day's world. In fact, they aren't necessarily good even if you do live up to them. This is a challenge to the foundation stones on which all the rest stands, even though we haven't oftentimes recognized that fact. Now, in a time of such confusion, surely it's urgent. I don't know any other word. I'd say that never was more urgent that we take our bearings afresh as Americans and American Christians. Is there a moral order in the universe? And if so, what is it? Now, I and the people say, well, we've got to create a moral order for our times. I don't hear them saying we got to create an astronomical order for our times. Our men wouldn't have started 1 foot toward the moon if they hadn't have been absolutely certain there is an astronomical order already created and for all times. What are they trying to do? Find out what that order is, so we can live with its laws instead of against them. I don't hear people saying, we've got to create a chemical order. Now go to think up what a table of atomic weights would be, should be, need. And yet all our laboratories and trying to find out what they are already created, those weights, and verifying them. I don't hear people in my profession say our task is to create a biological order. Is it conceivable that there could be in every other field of life an order already created, and yet in the most important field of all, the relation of persons to persons, which is the moral order, there is no order there, no laws there. There's a grain in the wood on this rostrum here. It wasn't painted on there. That's the way it grew out in the forest. Now, I can decide to go against the grain, or I can decide to go with the grain, but there is a grain. Or isn't there in the moral world? There's a North Star. I don't have to chart my course by it. I can ignore it and go any way I want, regardless of the compass. But there is a North Star. I could chart my course according to it if I so decide. Is there in the moral world no order? Or is there one that's there, created for all times, and our task is like the astronauts to re-examine again what is that order, what are its laws, so we can go with them instead of against them and bring trouble upon ourselves. Well, our question then becomes, are there any standards, and if so, what are they, that apply to all people, all races, all cultures, all classes, that apply to the employer and to the employee, to the rich and to the poor, to the black and to the white and the brown and the yellow and the red, to the majority and to the minority, to the male and to the female? If so, what are they? In a time of such confusion and uncertainty, by what standards are we to judge the suggestion that comes from this commentator or that senator, this professor or that clergyman or layman? How are we to judge whether we're going forward or backward? Whether it's good, constructive, or bad and destructive? In short, how can we make a united nation again out of our deeply divided American people? We've been accustomed to assassinations in other countries, and there could be riots and kidnappings and disruptions and disorder in other countries. And we could look down upon Greek government because it had corruption. or the Chinese government or some other countries where they spied on people, had secret police, but that would never happen in the United States. But it's happening. How can we make not only a united nation again out of our deeply divided peoples, but how can we build a united world of order and justice and peace out of this deeply divided and disordered world? Now, maybe we can get some guidance from those who have gone through troubled times in the past. And I'd like to use as an example from which we could learn something, I think, use as an example the children of Israel when they emerged from Egypt. I talked about this up at the governor's prayer breakfast in Denver 6 years ago, and some of you were perhaps there. But I don't flatter myself you remember what I said, although you'll remember the principles when I get to them, I hope. This more pertinent, more relevant, I think more biting today than they were there because of our own internal uncertainties. Here were people who'd been down in Egypt for 420 years. And they hadn't been given an opportunity to govern themselves in larger units than the family. They had blood ties. They were all of the Hebrew people. They had tribal ties, if you wish, and loyalties. And they had religious ties. But political or economic, no. The pharaohs made the decisions. And if you aren't allowed to make decisions, you lose the capacity to make decisions. If I were to tie my arm down for 6 months and take the bandage off, I would have lost the capacity to use it until a long period of redevelopment, what doctors call atrophy from disuse. Now, the Hebrew people hadn't learned how to manage themselves. They hadn't had an opportunity to. And now they go out into the wilderness. And they have to become a nation. They've got to become a political organism. They've got to think as a people instead of 12 tribes and a whole series of families. And as others than just those who worship one particular God. How could they get together? Same problem on a different phase somewhat that we're faced with today. Well, Moses struggling with this problem, how to weld an unwieldy conglomeration of tribes and families into a political organism that could survive. He went up into the mountain and God gave him or helped him work out, same thing, 10 basic principles for the life of Israel as a nation, a people. And the longer I worked in government, and more often I saw what happened when I or some of my colleagues were tempted to sort of shortcut some of these principles, the more convinced I became that there are no better on which we can build or rebuild our society together. I'll go further. I think there are no other. No other on which we can build a society, a nation, that will endure. These principles are not only relevant and valid for us, I think they're absolutely essential. And I want to run through them here, a minute and a half or 2 minutes to each one of them. You're familiar with them, but from this point of view, there are other points of view, but from this one point of view, nation building, society building, for a country that's deeply troubled. What was the first principle? The first principle was that God must be at the center or things won't go right. Just one of the laws that's in the nature of things. Things won't go right. Now, that means that you can't have at the center your own race, or your own nation, or your own class, or your own work even, or even your own family, and certainly not yourself, because these things all divide. If you say my nation, you divide. If you say my race, you divide. If you say my class, you divide horizontally instead of vertically. Self, you set yourself off. These divide, and our problem is how to get unity. Not power or prestige or position. Jehovah must be at the center. That doesn't mean the others don't count. They do. But the center has got to be God or things won't work right. Jesus took this same principle and developed it, expanded it, amplified, when he said, No man can serve two masters. Just can't do it. Got to have one. And the principle is that it's got to be God, or just things won't go right. Not because God is self-seeking and wants us to flatter him. No, no. But he doesn't want us to blunder along and wreck everything. He's trying to help us. Put him and his principles at the center so things will go. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Because if you do have, things won't go well. If you're going to build a nation or a life or a family. That's the first one. And the second is the same thing said in a different way. In almost the opposite way. The folly and the futility of putting your primary trust in things. The destructiveness, if you wish, of things temporal. Because things which can be possessed can be lost. And then what do you have? If your primary reliance is on things, they fail you. They don't endure. Jesus took this one and developed. He took the story of the rich young ruler, you know. And it was that story which got me into a Christian. A man told a story about this rich young ruler. What possibilities that fellow had. He had a good home. I'm sure his folks had given him a good education. He was attracted. It said Jesus looked on him and loved him. He had wealth, position, influence, power. What he could have done. But when the showdown came, he couldn't quite detach himself from his reliance on possessions. So this man at that talk, when I was a senior in high school, he said he was a quitter. And he turned around and walked out of history. Nobody ever heard of him again. Because, now, wealth wouldn't be at the center of my life because I don't have it. But something else is at the center. Pretty near always, mine and yours. And he's telling us, God's trying to help us quit stumbling along and making mistakes. You can't put something else at the center. It's foolish and it's futile. They don't stand up. He said, Jesus also said, seek ye first what? Peace? No, no. Seek ye first what? Freedom? No, didn't say that. Seek ye first prosperity, security, democracy. He didn't say not to seek them. He talked a lot about every one of them. But he said, don't seek them first because you won't get them. That isn't the way. Seek ye first, he said, his kingdom, his rule in the world, under his laws. And then these others will come along. I talked last time I was here about how to get peace. And we seek peace, seek peace, seek peace. We pray for peace. From Jeremiah said, the people cry peace, peace, and there is no peace. And almost Sunday, every Sunday I hear some clergyman, God send us peace. Well, he's never done it. 5,000 years recorded, he hasn't sent us peace. Jesus didn't say pray for peace. He said make peace. Work for it. Pray to help you make peace. But he isn't going to give it to you. Never has. Please, won't you give us peace? It isn't enough to want it or love it or parade for it or denounce war or renounce war or all the rest of the things we do. How are you going to make peace? And I'm not going to develop that anymore. I tried to last time. I just want to remind you of it. Seek ye first. It's because I want peace that I have to come back to seek ye first his kingdom. We say seek peace, have another conference, send over Dr. Kissinger and get another piece of paper. And then we'll have the kingdom. It's wrong way around. Seek ye first his kingdom and then the other things come. That doesn't mean we shouldn't seek it, but we have to get them in the right order. The folly and the futility of putting our trust in things. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, because things at the center will fail you. Now the third one is the sacredness of the divine human relationship. How do you get God at the center? Well, there are two conditions, and the third has to do with the negative, and the fourth has to do with the positive. How do you get God at the center? The negative is you mustn't exploit this relationship. You mustn't profane it. Any relationship that's exploited for selfish purposes is damaged, if not ruined. My, how we do that. How do you profane God's name? Well, we ordinarily think of cursing, calling God down God's wrath on our fellow human beings. But as that isn't the commonest way, and the more dangerous way. The commonest way is when we use this name carelessly, mechanically, in hymns, or in prayers even. And my, how many people use this name for selfish purposes when they get into politics. They rediscover the church very quickly, so they start running for office. They may get respectability by going to the church and maybe win some votes. And people go into a new community and he joins the church because that puts him in with the best people, you know. This ruins a relationship. Bound to. If you use a relationship between two friends or between a man and a woman for selfish purposes, it spoils it. And if you exploit, try to, for selfish purposes, the relation between man and God, it spoils it. Doesn't wreck God. It does wreck man. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Because it'll alienate you from God instead of bringing you close to you, to the center. Now that leads to the fourth, which is the claim of God upon a portion of our time. And that means our attention, our work, our substance, our life. That is, to refrain from profaning, exploiting, cheapening, trifling with this divine human relationship is not enough. You got to give it positive attention, nurture, time. The old hymn puts it, take time to be holy. You can't develop a real, close, satisfying, rich, rewarding, enduring relationship with the woman you love enough to ask to be your wife unless you give time and attention to it and to her, can you? What makes us think we can develop a good, close, rewarding, helpful, satisfying, unifying relationship with Jehovah? If we don't give time to it, give time to it. A nation, a man that pays no attention to these foundations loses his bearings, loses his poise. A nation that doesn't pay attention to the spiritual heritage out of which these good material results came loses its bearings and loses its poise. Now the Sabbath, you see, is a symbol of this law. The requirement of a portion of your time being given to things of the Spirit. The Sabbath, not just a time to go home and rest and build up again to go back to work. No. The Sabbath, a time for cultivation of a closer relationship between you and God and alone and with other pilgrims on the same mission, other Christians in the fellowship of the church or the men's organization. You can't build it in any field, this kind of relationship, without time and attention, study, communication. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now the fifth is the sacredness of the home, which is the pattern of organization of every good society there's ever been in history, if you go back and examine. And look at the disintegration of the home in our time and the results thereof. You've seen studies on delinquency after World War I, in which I served. The average age of major criminals was 29. Now it's under 19. And the one factor that's commonest, way ahead of all the rest of not slums and poverty and lack of education and so on, is a broken home. Way ahead of any other. Not necessarily where the father and mother have separated. Just as often where they're still in the same roof, but they chew each other out. Maybe even hate each other. And the kid loves them both. It's almost impossible to make a child hate a father or a mother who has given him any affection for the first 2 or 3 years. He may kill him. But it's because he loves him and he's hurt and torn so. Not because he hates him. No wonder he goes out and hot rods and steals automobiles and throws big brickbats through windows to escape from the suffering of the tension between the two whom he loves most. I don't think it's an accident that the two longest continuous civilizations in history are the two that made the home central, the family, the Jewish and the Chinese. Others came and went, and they lost here and there, and they were captured, but they kept together because in both cases, honor thy father and thy mother more than any other group. Not just counsel, friendly, nice to have met you, Dad, I appreciate all you've done for me. No, a law. I just don't think you can build a good society, an enduring society, unless it's one in which the home is a holy, really a sacred institution. So important that Jesus on the cross, in almost the last hour of his life, paid attention to it. He saw his mother, and he said to her, "Behold thy son." And to the beloved disciple, "Behold thy mother." Remember, honor thy father and thy mother. Not just niceness. This is the law, my friends. I think. Now, just as it was in their day. Now, the next is the sacredness of human life. And that means not only the body, but it means the spirit, surely. The whole person. And never has there been a time when life is so cheap as now. On a mass scale. This really began in the 20s in Russia when Stalin went out to force the kulaks to give up their property. Old Lenin, after the revolution in 1917, he couldn't get into power and get it organized. The armies of the Tsar were wandering, marauding, living off the people, violence, and he had to get the people behind him. So what did he do? He did what they do. Now, he abandoned temporarily the basic principles. Marx had said the essence of communism, of Marxism, could be put in one phrase, the abolition of private property. And old Lenin says, if you'll support me, I'll give you land, private property. And Trotsky denounced him as a revisionist, the same as Mao Zedong now denounces Brezhnev, and Brezhnev denounces Mao Zedong as revisionist, no true prophet. But old Lenin was pretty cagey. He was a good football quarterback. He knew how to fake a handoff to the right and then pass to the left. And we don't denounce the fullback or the quarterback saying he's a bad man. I never thought he'd deceive that other team. Nice looking young kid. He's supposed to deceive the other team. Communism's based on deception. And it's honorable and praiseworthy for them to deceive. But we insist on projecting our ideas into their minds, and then we're outraged when they say this and do that. No. So the people supported Lenin when he gave him land, and then he got into power, and these folks wanted to have something to say about their own lives. And so Stalin tried to take it away from them, and then he executed 6 million of them. And then Hitler came along and he executed Jews, not because this one was a criminal or that one was unworthy or this one was feeble-minded. No, just because they were Jews. And then the Chinese communists executed, according to the studies put out by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, 34 million. Old Smoothie Joe Enlai. He took on General Marshall and took on Mr. Nehru and took on Mr. Sukarno, took on Mr. Kenyatta and raped them, really. The greatest murderers in all human history, but charming football players. Never in all of history has there been a time when human life was so cheap. And I'll tell you, a society in which the life of an individual is not secure against the power of the state unless he's convicted of a crime, is a society which can't endure. The sacredness of human life. Now, this is a particularly difficult principle to deal with in time of war. Because some say that a Christian must not fight in war because killing is forbidden. No, killing is not forbidden. Murder is forbidden. The word is murder. The same chapter, the same book, which says thou shalt not kill, also prescribes five conditions under which you should take life, execute. It's prescribed, thou shalt not murder. And this is a difficult problem. I was sorely torn after World War I, and I came back, and a disenchantment that comes after every war. The war didn't fail. The war did all anybody had it could ask of a war. All a war can do is decide who's going to have the chance to determine the future. World War I determined that we and the Allies would have it and not the Kaiser. Now, we didn't carry through, but that was our fault, not the fault of the war. And World War I. World War II determined that the Axis, Hitler and Mussolini and Japan's military, weren't going to have the opportunity. Did all that a war could do. But nevertheless, in reaction against it, the temptation was to take the position, under no circumstances can I kill. And I respect completely the individual who did it. But I couldn't take it in the end, because I'd be solving my problem. I could say, well, I didn't kill anybody, but more people might be killed. The number one obstacle to a decent peace in Vietnam way back in 1968 after the Tet Offensive was the peace forces in the United States. Every time they paraded and said, oh, this, that, and the other thing, we told the North, keep on killing, just keep on killing, keep on killing. Don't you see the parades? Don't you see the resolutions? Don't you see the people, the pacifists on the steps of the Capitol reading the names of all the Americans of being killed and never mention the ones who killed them? I wouldn't want all that blood on my hand. 2/3 of all our dead were killed after we started protecting the enemy's rear. So he was secure in the north and free to kill in the south. What do you do when you don't have a choice between killing and not killing? It's immoral to kill, yes. Is it moral to stand by and see innocent people slaughtered? Is that moral? Which is the greater immorality, or which is the lesser immorality? Which will lead to less killing? I don't ever try to make an answer for anybody but myself. For myself, I think it means thou shalt not go into propositions which will lead, insofar as you have control of them, to killing of people. I learned a lot about that from my Chinese teacher one time. I studied 3 hours a day after the first year, and one of the hours as a teacher, I always read in the scriptures because I thought I knew what it meant. I found that mostly I didn't, because it's an Oriental book and I didn't understand the Oriental imagery. And one day we were reading in the Old Testament and the commandments, and after at the end of the hour we stopped for 10 minutes of tea while we got ready for the next hour. And he said to me, you know, I heard one of your preachers, he was not a Christian, he was a Chinese gentleman. He said, I heard one of your Christian preachers talking about this one time, and he said, he read that as if it said, thou shalt not kill the body. He said, it doesn't say that. He says, thou shalt not kill. And we think, and he said, your own teacher, Jesus, said, don't be afraid of those who can kill the body, be afraid of those who can kill the body and the soul. And we think it's more cruel to crush the human spirit, as they tried to do with our POWs, you know, than it is even to kill the body. Because the spirit's eternal, and the body's not. Well, I learned something. At least I had to think. Thou shalt not kill. Now, the next is the sacredness of the sex relations in the bonds of matrimony. Well, of course, all sex relations ought to be sacred, because anything so intimate, so personal as the sex relations are spoiled if there's promiscuity. But the sex relations must be especially sacred in matrimony. Why? Because vows have been taken. A home has been established. Society depends upon that social unit, the family. And if there's promiscuity, then the home deteriorates, the society deteriorates and fails. Now, this isn't a matter of ancient preachments or traditional habits or moral precepts or old customs. This is a matter of moral law. If you'd have a sound, enduring, helpful society. I always appreciated something the Archbishop of Canterbury said at the time King Edward VIII abdicated the throne of Britain in order to marry a woman who, in the eyes of the church, was another woman's wife, another man's wife. And the Archbishop said, many a man has found himself being attracted to a woman who is another man's wife. That is no sin. That is no crime. That is no disgrace. He said it is a sin. It is a disgrace if he yields to that attraction. Vows have been taken. He's entered into a covenant. And often, usually, they're children. And he can't break those without not only injuring himself, but deteriorating the society. The great British scholar J.D. Unwin at Cambridge made a study some years ago, or he published it some years ago, of 80 civilizations. That includes little civilizations here and there that didn't have any great world impact but had a certain distinctive character. And his conclusion at the end, he put in these words, every people is free to exert great creative energy or to enjoy sexual freedom. The evidence is it cannot do both for more than one generation. Of course, this is Karl Marx's libido. You've got a creative urge. You can put it into sex or you can put it into building something great. Art, literature, government, industry, whatever it is. But you can't do them both. If you want to pursue the one, you don't wind up with the other. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Now, the next is a double one. The sacredness first of reputation. The sacredness of... The next one is the sacredness. It's a double one, but it's the sacredness of property. The sacredness of possessions. It's double in the sense that the sacredness of the other person's possessions and the sacredness of your own. What a cheapening there's been in recent years of the pride in many business circles. Watergate's merely a climax of it. The number of high-grade leaders in our country, prominent in all sorts of praiseworthy endeavor, who come down and no low contendery when something comes up, they've been engaged in illegal collusion on markets or prices, marketing or prices. They have cheated on tax returns. They have falsified records. They've misrepresented their product. Well, if we do that, it's not surprising it gets into politics. You can't be tolerated, but it's not surprising. And there are some who assault the very principle of the sacredness of property. They talk about human rights and property rights. Human rights, noble property rights, something you should be ashamed of. But they haven't thought very deeply, I can assure you of that. Now, property has no rights. But to earn and own property is a human right. Communists talk about dictatorship of the proletariat. That's not gibberish. That means something. Why should they want nobody to have property? Marx said the abolition of private property, because without property you cannot stand up against the tyranny of the state. Many a man who will walk into a machine gun and give his life for his country will, if the only way he can get a ration card and food for his family, because he has no property, he has no chickens, no pigs, no garden, no rice stashed away. The only way he can feed his family is to knuckle under. It's easy to control people without property. You can't defend your human rights unless you're able to feed yourself and your family while you resist the tyrant. And yet we hear an awful lot of stuff that doesn't pay much attention to that. Abraham Lincoln thought about it. They wanted him to come out and denounce property in order to help the poor and so on. He said, why, the poor man is the one who should be most insistent on the right to earn and own property. because only as every man can keep the property he has legitimately owned, is there any chance for the poor man to earn more and himself become rich? Ah, we've gotten so sophisticated and so smart. The sacredness of property, the refusal to take what doesn't belong to you. Now, if we stop there, I think we'd be misled. I can earn and own and do just as I please with my property, but that's not involved. There's more involved in this law. The sacredness of one's own property. The obligation to use it as a trust for the benefit. Take care of your legitimate needs, but basically for the benefit of society, for human well-being. Thou shalt not steal from another man or from God if you don't regard it as sacred. Now the next is again doubled. The sacredness of reputation. First, for the sake of the man who slandered. My, this is the hardest thing to take in public life. Two doctors will disagree strongly. One thinks we should operate, no, we should wait 24 hours. But neither goes around and tells the relatives that that other guy is trying to kill the patient. They're both trying to get the patient. Well, there's an honest difference of opinion of how. But in public life, if you disagree, it can't be that you really love your country and just as concerned as other people. You have to be. Somebody's bought you off. You got something unworthy. I tell you, the looseness with which the attacks have been made on people's good name without evidence in some of these recent things. A lot of things wrong. But the way in which it's been so carelessly spread over people, all that mud can't be thrown without it sticking. Shakespeare put it, "Who steals my purse steals trash. But he who filches from my good name robs me of that which not enriches him and makes me poor indeed." But then this is even worse, in my opinion, for the person who slanders than it is for the person who is slandered. Hard as it is. Because the man who slanders is corroded more inside than the man who is improperly attacked. Now, the other side of this is the sacredness of the pledged word. My friends, I don't think there's any possible hope of a world of order, justice, and of peace unless the pledged word of a nation can be trusted. And my, look at all the betrayals of the pledged word in recent years. I know something of the pressure that was put upon our presidents, upon President Roosevelt and President Truman and President Eisenhower and President Kennedy and Johnson and upon President Nixon to break our word. And we did, repeatedly. Chiang Kai-shek came to Cairo in 1943 and his people were exhausted. He'd been fighting since 1938. And fighting on our side for 4 years when we didn't have brains enough to know it was our side. We were helping the Japanese military. And he was afraid, and so he came to Cairo and said, "Are we going to get Manchuria back or not?" Because the Chinese wanted to develop the conditions and the better conditions in their own people, and they couldn't do it without greater resources. And the area where there were grain surpluses and coal, coking coal, and iron ore, and industrial capacity, potential, was Manchuria. If they'd been willing to let it go, they wouldn't have had a war with Japan. They had to have Manchuria. But now there were all these things going on, would they get it back? And our president made a public commitment in writing and in words in which he said Manchuria at the end of the war will go back to its rightful owners, the Chinese. And then the president went over to Tehran and under pressures gave control of Manchuria 20 days later to the Soviet Union. Jiang went back to his people and told them this, and they buttoned up their belt and saved thousands of American lives. Some of you are probably living today who wouldn't have been if Japan had been able to free that extra 1¾ million men to fight us instead of being tied down in China. And then when President Truman came in and found out in the spring of 45 that it had been done, he sent word over to our ambassador to tell Jiang he wasn't going to get Manchuria. General Hurley was the ambassador. He didn't want to do it. He wanted Ed Wedemeyer, who was our military man, and he didn't want to do it. They told us this in our committee. The two of them came, and they said, well, we went in together, and we told him, yeah, he wasn't going to get it back because we broke our word. We had to please our adversary, didn't we? And now we talk about another Atlantic Charter for Europe. The Atlantic Charter said there was to be no territorial aggrandizement after this war. No changes in sovereignty without the freely expressed will of the people. And then two, three men went to Yalta and sat down and divided up this and divided up that, and you take this one and that'll be in my sphere of influence, and then wrote the United Nations Charter, not to establish justice, as our Constitution says, but to maintain peace and security. Please it the way it is, we fellows divided up. I thought the Atlantic Charter was a set of principles. So did you. And then they decided there wasn't even a copy of it, just a document. And then we wonder why some people are today afraid to trust us. What would you do if you were Willy Brandt in Germany? We disarmed Germany. The Germans had done most of the basic work out of which came nuclear weapons. German scientists had done most of the basic work out of which came rockets to deliver them. You remember V1 and V2. But we said to the Germans, you never can have anything to do with your own inventions. You must sit here with all those forces on your border, essentially defenseless, and trust us to use your inventions to defend you if they move into you as they moved into Czechoslovakia, and they can do it tonight. But if we didn't keep our word in Vietnam, or we didn't keep our word elsewhere, can the Germans trust us to keep our word there? This is what the war in Vietnam was about, not General Tu or General Diem. It was about human rights. Is the pledged word of the United States any good? That's what it was about. Us. I don't think that's hard to understand. It's very hard to deal with. The sanctity of the pledged word. The worst thing we did in World War II, in my opinion, was when we asked the Russians to violate their agreement with Japan to come into the war against Japan. Japan and Russia was smart. She had two enemies, one on her west, Hitler, and one on her east, Japan. So she made a deal with Hitler to divert him to the west, so he had a second front before he got around to Russia. And she made a deal with Japan. She had a treaty of friendship and non-violent, that's not the word, huh? Yeah, that's right, with Japan. Each side kept it circumspectly. And we sent 600 shiploads of arms right through the Japanese islands to Vladivostok during the war, and the Japanese never sank a one of them. They had all they could do with the Chinese and us after we recovered from Pearl Harbor without taking on Russia. And the Japanese kept it and the Russians kept it. And then our Secretary of State, at a night in August 1945, already after we dropped the bomb, and Japan was suing for peace, our Secretary of State, with great enthusiasm, announced that we had persuaded the Russians to break their agreement with Japan and come into the war. And the Secretary of State said, well, we did it to save lives. I myself had a boy on a destroyer in the Pacific, and that's right. He didn't want him to have to land in Japan. And if I'd have been out there, probably I'd have been praying that the Russians would come in and knock Japan out so I wouldn't have to land. But the fact remains that, as Wendell Wookie once put it, every drop of blood saved through expediency of that sort gets paid for by 20 drawn by the sword. Couldn't have kept the Russians out. This was the lowest moment. They wanted to be in 5 days, to be in on the settlement. But we asked them to break their word. It's terrible when Hitler breaks his word, or Mussolini breaks his word, or Japan breaks his word, or anybody else. But it's all right for our case. My time's up, but I want to read one more thing, because this is on this point, because I think it's important. During the winter of 42, 43, I guess it was. Rommel was coming across Africa toward Egypt, trying to get over and break the Suez Canal, the lifeline of Britain from Australia, New Zealand, and the colony of Commonwealth of India. And after they drove the British off the continent in 1940, it was that next winter, Hitler moved his Panzer divisions over and came down through Yugoslavia and Greece. and they were going to pinch it off, you see. And Britain, under a previous administration, had made an agreement, a signed treaty with Greece, to help her, a common, today we call it mutual defense. Naturally, the Greeks called for help. Well, what Mr. Churchill was the prime minister. He could have said, well, I didn't make that. That was my predecessor. And besides, it wasn't realistic. It shouldn't have been made in the first place. It was a mistake. And besides, we're fighting with our back to the wall. This was before Pearl Harbor. There wasn't any certainty Britain would pull through. But Mr. Churchill honored the agreement and took a third of all the forces that were trying to defend the lifeline and moved them into Greece. And they were clobbered. 6,000 of them were killed. When you get off the airport in Athens and start in down toward the Acropolis, about 2 miles from the airport, two and a half, you pass a graveyard on the right where a lot of those English boys are buried. Mr. Churchill was torn to pieces in England. The flower of Britain's youth was being sacrificed for a rotten, fascistic, corrupt, semi-dictatorial, undemocratic government in Greece. Mr. Churchill went on the air. April 28, 1941, 7.5 months before Pearl Harbor. And this is what he said to the British people. In their mortal peril, the Greeks turned to us for succor. Strained as were our own resources, we could not say them nay. By solemn guarantee given before the war, Great Britain had promised them her help. They declared they would fight for their native soil even if none of their neighbors made common cause with them and even if we left them to their fate. But we could not do that. There are rules against that kind of thing. And to break those rules would be fatal to the honor of the British Empire, without which we could neither hope nor deserve to win this hard war. He didn't save Greece, but he rallied his British people and saved England and Western civilization. That's greatness. Thou shalt not bear false witness. A lot of commitments we shouldn't have made. I fought against them. But when you make them, there's a law here if you want to have a decent order. Now, finally, we come around full circle to the last one. Full circle to the first one. And the principle is the menace of an unsound heart. Because instead of God at the center, self is at the center. A cancer. Greedy, acquisitive. Unsound and dangerous to society and a cancer to the man who has it. Covetousness eats him up. Thou shalt not covet. All right. Now here are the 10 laws, and I took too long. The principles that God gave Moses for Israel, I believe they're unchanging laws for us too, and for all time. Moses came down from the mountain and his face shone. Now he had the answer for his people and what had happened. Well, while he'd been gone, the people said, we don't know what's happened to that Moses. We got to have something tangible that we can depend on. Let's make us a god of gold, and we don't ask anybody to give it up. We'll chip in our own rings, our own earrings, our bracelets. We'll have deductions from our payroll to give us security. And they were dancing around it for joy. And what did Moses do? He did what most of us do when we're caught under pressure. He broke under the strain. He lost his temper. He cast the tables at the foot of the mountain, broke them. Broke the very laws that he'd come down to give as the laws for his people, to make a nation. And he said, who's on our side? Who's on the Lord's side? And the sons of Levi came over and they set to and murdered some 3,000, slaughtered 3,000 of their brethren. And then Moses had a bad night. And he went out in the morning like a father yearning over a wayward son, and he said, oh, this people have sinned a great sin and made them gods of gold. Can you think of any other country of which that might be said, or people? Yet he said, if thou wilt forgive their sin, and if not, then I pray thee, blot me out of thy book which thou hast written. If my people go down, I don't ask to be saved. I go with them. But if you can, Lord, give us another chance. And what did the Lord say? And here we are to the meat for us very quickly. He said to Moses, hew thee two tables of stone like unto the first. Moses, go right back where you got off the track and get on the track. And if America's confused and doesn't know what to do in all this, get back on the track. Hew thee two tables of stone like unto the first. And the Lord said, I will write upon these new tables the words that were on the first tables, which thou breakest. Same words. Same words as given to Moses 4,000 years ago, taken and elaborated and amplified and reinforced by Jesus 2,000 years ago, written into the basic documents of our own country, under this nation, under God. The same words. Same laws for character building, same laws for home building, same laws for business building, same laws for community building, same laws for nation building, same laws for peace building. God's unchanging eternal laws. Or are they? I'm tempted to pause for just a moment to read you something that's in the book of Nehemiah. I'm sure you've seen it. Nehemiah 8th chapter starts in. If you want to ask some questions, I think I'd be glad to elaborate on it a little bit. It starts out and said, the people gathered in the street before the water gate, asking again to have the laws of God and as given to Moses brought to them. So they, the priests and the scribes, read in the book of the laws of God distinctly, and gave the sense and caused them to understand the reading. I don't know anything more pertinent for us today. So Moses went ahead after he'd said, hew thee two tables of stone, and I'll write on the tables the same words were on the first table which thou breakest. He said, and be ready in the morning. Now don't fool around, Moses. Get at this right now. That's the right time. That's why it's good to have morning meetings of laymen. This prayer group movement, I think, is useful. Before the day gets too involved and too tied up, right early in the morning. And the Lord said, come up in the morning, Moses, unto Mount Sinai. Come up. Life is climbing. It's not coasting. Life is climbing. I don't think that's a curse. That's a blessing. You grow out of climbing. And the Lord said, present thyself there to me in the top of the mountain. Not the bottom, that isn't good enough. Not the middle of the mountain, that isn't good enough. But the top of the mountain. Maybe even up here at this place, in the top, in the mountains. Where you're clear, the sky is clearest, your mind's clearest. The telephone's not ringing, you aren't distraught and distracted. At the top of the mountain. Present thyself there to me. Discuss, yes. Examine, yes. But dedicate. Present thyself there to me in the top of the mountain. And he added one more sentence, and let no man come with you. My friends, every home, every man and woman, every people has got to have its own reckoning with the Almighty. And Moses made haste. He didn't fool around. He took the initiative. He made haste and he bowed his head to the earth and he worshiped. And he said, O Lord, let my Lord, I pray thee, go again in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people. Pardon our iniquity, forgive our sins, and take us again as thine inheritance. Blessed was our nation, this nation, when its God was the Lord. Blessed again and always will be this nation, and every nation, whose God is the Lord. Shall we pray? Lord God of hosts, be with us yet, lest we forget. Lest we forget. Amen.